Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. In springtime, allergies can sometimes be my kryptonite. When my nose is plugged up and my eyes are watering, I feel like I struggle more to do the things I really enjoy. Making dinner, heading outside to get my sunlight before noon, and even hosting the show can be a bit more challenging. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medication and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for several years, and it's been an absolute life changer. My eyes aren't a constant, itchy, drippy faucet, my nose isn't running, and I can speak without feeling like something has jumped in my throat. And I love that Claritin D tackles nasal congestion caused by allergies or cold, and also relieves sinus congestion and pressure due to allergies. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Use as directed. Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Ginny Urich. I'm the founder of 1000 Hours Outside. And I have a friend of a friend here today, which is always so fun. Erin Lochner has connected us, and I love Erin. Jessica Elefante, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here. I love Erin too. She's the ultimate connector.
She sure is. So you have a book that came out called Raising Hell, Living Well, Freedom from Influence in a World Where Everyone Wants Something from You, Including Me. That's great. And it does feel like that. It really does feel like that's the type of world that we live in. And I love how you have verbalized that so well. And the book just does that. It's like, oh yeah, that's why I'm feeling that way. That's why I'm feeling, I want to have freedom from this influence. But I would love to start, Jessica, with this. I have never in my life seen a book that has such a long acknowledgments section. I loved it. I was like person after person after person. So I would love to start even just with our connection. Like, talk to me about how you know Erin, and is it like through writing? Is it through blogging? Like, where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, it's through writing. It's actually through my former sort of media brand, which was called Folk Rebellion, which was really, you know, 10 years ago, trying to advocate for a better use of technology, just throwing the hand up in the air saying, hey, how we're using this isn't really the healthiest or best way, and we could be smart about it and be mindful and make some changes. And so she had written, you know, obviously her incredible books, Chasing Slow. And I was connected through her through another amazing connector named Alyssa, if she's listening, she'll know. And so anyway, we just developed this beautiful email, internet, you know, friendship, which is one of the reasons why I love the internet, because you find like-minded people who feel the way you do and see the things that you do, but you can make them into much more substantial relationships. And so even though Erin and I have yet to meet in person, she is invited to stay at my house anytime and hang out with me and my family and my kids. And she has invited me out to hers, and we are going to make it happen one day.
I've met her at conferences, and so we've hung out in person, and also her kids do these really cool plays in Indiana. So we've gone to some of those, but we also have talked about like meeting up. Our middle ground is this place called Tacancha, and we just never happened. But I think they're building like a yurt resort, or we can all go out to the yurts. I did think that the acknowledgments in the back were so special. It was just like person after person. And I love that. It's like people are so important, and the internet does make a way for us to meet people that we wouldn't have met otherwise. But your story is that you fell apart a bit. You were on the forefront of all of this digital stuff. You were there kind of connecting this new wave of person and generation to the old people that are running the companies and helping them figure out how do we navigate this new stuff. And then it kind of imploded. Can you talk about how you felt then? And this is even before anyone was talking about that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. The term digital detox wasn't even really a term at that point. You know, I just, I really started to become concerned. I'd say the number one symptom was memory loss, and specifically word recalls. So I was, as you said, operating on behalf of, you know, brands and corporations in the digital world. At first, they thought social media or the digital realm was just this thing that they could ignore, and then very quickly realized that, oh, we should have a Facebook page. And I taught a viral networking 101 class to small business owners and help them set up their Facebook pages. So
You are on the forefront. I mean, right at the forefront of all of that.
And that's the only reason that I had the success in the career that I did, because I was able to speak to the old guard in a language they were accustomed of typical marketing and advertising, but translate that. You know, I'm a writer, I'm a photographer, I'm an artist. So it was very, very easy for me when the internet happened to be able to say, oh, I could do this. I could translate what your brand wants to communicate into this digital space. And back then, it was very personal. Like when I was operating all the social media profiles, you know, I was the only, you know, I guess today it would be called community manager for everyone. I was setting it up. And I guess what happened was when you have a whole bunch of clients, and because it was so new, we did not have the huge teams that are built out for these digital universes now. It was just me. I was communicating 24/7 on behalf of all of them, on behalf of all of their platforms. And so I noticed just this feeling of going from point A to point B, you know, when you're driving a car and you don't remember driving there. That was kind of how my days were, which then turned into how my weeks were. But the most terrifying thing, the biggest symptom, was I would say things like the sticks for clothes, right? So instead of saying hanger, I couldn't think of the word hanger. I would say the sticks you put your clothes on, which is really, really scary. And then the other ones were just like brain fog, malaise, disassociation, obviously like loneliness, isolation, but I didn't even really acknowledge that at that point in time. For me, it was just the cognitive decline of my memory.
It's so interesting because Jonathan Haidt talks about this period of 2010 to 2015 as this rewiring of childhood. He calls it, in this 5-year period, we moved from a play-based childhood to a phone-based childhood. And you say in your book that the digital dementia wasn't even coined until 2015. So we've had this incredible pace of technology adoption, even just as you're saying, what a joke to say you had to set up someone's Facebook page. This has changed so fast, and yet our knowledge of what's really going on inside of us has been a lot slower. You felt it long before there was a name for it. You said, I couldn't wait for the researchers to catch up. I simply had to opt out of what was making me sick and start anew. When you're right, it's funny. It's serious and funny at the same time. So you were talking about how in 2018, this is so funny, Jessica, you're going to the Influence Her Conference. You're like, that is actually the name of what I'm doing, the Influence Her Conference. And you said you collapsed in the airport and it took, you know, a month or so to sort of recalibrate. What happened there?
Well, so I had left my job in corporate America working with brands to start Folk Rebellion in 2014. So I started feeling unwell in 2012. And I had a son. And at the time, he was 1.5, 2 years old. And if I became this wholly addicted to my devices that made me so unwell, which I figured out on my own, having grown up at like the gateway to the Adirondack Mountains, being the girl who was like the crunchy hippie who hiked every day and sat slept outside in her backyard under the stars, I had a very analog childhood. If I had had this experience, I couldn't imagine what it was going to be like for this kid, my kid, and all other kids who'd never known any different, who'd never seen any different, who'd never had any adult tell them that it used to be different. So that's why I quit. And I started Folk Rebellion in 2014, which back then people thought I was nuts. And now, you know, to hear you say Jonathan Haidt says like 2010 to 2015, that was exactly during my usage. That was exactly when I made the shift. Of course, I started way earlier, but that's when I started to really notice things. And so I started Folk Rebellion and it took off really fast because people were feeling like I was. I didn't realize how many. And it just kind of got, I got scooped up in this wave where I was traveling all over the country speaking about digital wellness, digital well-being, mindful technology. I was giving keynotes and workshops to corporations once again, saying, you know, you have to factor this in both for your team so that they keep their brains, right? If they, you make money off of people being able to connect and have word recall, you can't have them online all the time. You can't be texting them at 2 a.m, but also how to put it in their own marketing campaigns, because this was becoming a trend, right? A zeitgeist of the times. Yeah. And so a leopard really doesn't change their spots. And I hadn't done enough work to realize that I was also, it wasn't just the technology, it wasn't just this digital world, but I was also under the influence of my own upbringing and the time at which I came of age and the time at which my career was. So my career also at the Digital Nexus was the girl boss nexus, right? So I was to strive as hard as humanly possible to be as successful as possible. And I did it for Folk Rebellion in an altruistic mission this time. I really do believe like it came from a good place. It wasn't ego, but at some point that catches up with it. It was, I wanted to fix the world for my kids, but it was a really, really big boulder to push uphill by yourself. And so now today to go to, you know, a responsible tech summit with All Tech is Human on Monday night, and there's a waiting list of 500 people outside to come in and, you know, speak about how we can fix this. I'm hopeful for the first time in a very long time that we can shift things, that we really can.
Yeah. And you're even working with, it's called Mothers Against Media Addiction, co-chair. So tell us what that's about.
Mamas. So
Mamas. Oh, because it's an acronym. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So it's modeled after Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And it was founded by Julie Skelfel, who is a journalist who's been covering tech for a very long time. And she just got really frustrated at the end of the day of, you know, she's reporting on this, she's sharing it. It's not 2014. We have the understanding. Yes. We see that nobody is well. We see that our democracy is faltering. We see that society is struggling. The kids are a hot mess. And now, thanks to Jonathan Haidt, we have like irrefutable proof that like it's the phones, it's the tech, right? You know, people wanted to say it was the pandemic, it was this. So Julie was like, well, threw her hands up in the air. You know, another child had killed themselves because of being exploited on TikTok. And she said, well, I just have to do this. I have to start this. It has to come from the parents. It has to come from the parents. We have to create a grassroots movement to push, you know, change in schools, change in what's accepted in society, and change in legislation. And so it just announced, you know, a week and a half ago. And we have some really amazing initiatives coming up, and it's growing faster. We have people reaching out from all over the country wanting to get involved. But when it's a true grassroots movement, we, you know, we didn't found this with an infrastructure in place. It's just like, sure, hey, we have a problem, we want to fix it. So we're playing catch up right now to try and, you know, involve all the people who are offering to help. And so that also makes me feel really, really, really hopeful.
Yes. Yes. It's impacting everyone. One of the things that you talked about in this book that I had never considered, and I thought that this was a really helpful and meaningful reframe, because we talk a lot about digital detox and we talk about, you know, putting our phone away or trying less of this or trying less of that. But really, you're making a case for influence detox. And that changes the way I look at it for sure. You know, it's not really the phone. It's the fact that there are all these companies that are trying to influence, and they're taking all of our pieces of data, and there's these algorithms. How can looking at it as, I want less influence, there's so much, and it didn't used to be that way. How does looking at it that way help us to pull back a little bit?
I think the trick is just in seeing it and understanding that it's there in the first place. And so that was really what I decided to do with this book, was make it feel all encompassing and a bit overwhelming. I chose like the culture of influence, right? We're influenced based off of the zip code we were born in, the body of which we arrived into the world, all the way up through then the culture of which we exist, the decade of when we were raised. And then, you know, as I talk about, we become under the influence of everything from media and corporations, politicians, other people's motivations, could be family members, boyfriends. And the way I get, you know, took the arc of the book is because it can feel like so overwhelming that you just throw your hands up in the air. And so I always say to my own son, like, how do you eat an elephant? You know, one bite at a time. And so I wanted to structure this where I show you what those influences are. They're called, you know, there's your inner world, your surface world, and the outer world. And some are fixed, some are things you can change. And there's some that are just like the air that we breathe around us. And once you start to recognize them, I think there's a prompt in there of like trying to count all the times throughout the day where you have been persuaded, coerced, pushed to take an action, whether intentionally or unintentionally, from, you know, how you take your coffee in the morning to the fact that you comply when you stop at a traffic light. But when you start to see that everything is pulling your strings a little bit, and of course we need influence to have a functioning society, it's in knowing that it's there to begin with that you can choose whether you want to participate or not. And I'll tell you just a really kind of quick, funny story. My mother read my book, and, you know, she's in her 60s, her mid 60s, and she's called me. It was about a month after she read the book, and she goes, "I have something I have to tell you." And I go, "What?" She goes, "You've ruined it. You've ruined everything." And I go, "What are you talking about?" She goes, "I can't unsee it anymore." I go, "What can't you unsee?" And she goes, "Influence. It's everywhere. Everyone's trying to get me to buy something, do something, believe something, shop something, sell something, moves." And I was like, "Oh, sorry, Mom." And it's kind of like that laugh track in a sitcom. When someone points it out to you, you can never not hear it again. And right. I didn't see any books out there. I've read every book there is on how to influence in every type of way, whether it's parenting or business or just how to win friends and influence people. It was one of my core inputs as a young adult. But I saw nothing out there to explain to people how they're being influenced and the culture of influence at large. And so that's why I put the book this way, so that people could start to just see.
It's really good because it does change your mindset of this is not really about the phone. It's not about the medium. It is about the fact that there are so many strings being pulled. And this is one of the sentences I have bolded all caps and I colored it purple so I wouldn't miss it. But you said the most powerful and pervasive, this is like exactly what your mom is talking about. The most powerful and pervasive types of persuasion are inconspicuous. You said today targeting dopamine covertly is big business because, I mean, like we're starting to kind of know that it's going on, but there were so many eye-opening things in here, Jessica. Like you're talking about, okay, you're in the forefront of this, right? You're in the forefront of this influencer, like people just used to be influential, but this influencer is now a new word. You're at the forefront. You're helping people set up Facebook pages, but you have no idea. This says Facebook is said to collect more than 52,000 data points on every user, and that businesses that leverage that outperform their competitors by 85%. What a cycle. So of course, I mean, if you choose to step out of it, then your competitors are 85% beyond what you're doing. But if you stay in it, then you're collecting all of this stuff about people and it's kind of under the surface. Like everybody knows, right? Everybody knows, oh, your phone's listening to you. Like that, these are common, but 52,000 data points? Wow, Jessica.
That's probably very outdated since I wrote it. But yes, and so that's the thing is if you either, like you said, if you choose to opt out of it, then your business might fail. And so that's why, you know, people who are out there advocating that data should be owned by us, it should be our right, we should be protected, specifically the children. And that if you choose to opt into it with knowledge, not these, you know, updates that happen where they're automatically selling your stuff and shipping it off to X, Y, and Z without your understanding, but where we're really protected, it's only going to get worse. And the reason it's so dangerous is because the more it learns about you or the more these entities learn about you, the more they can target you. And we're not talking about like, okay, you like Taylor Swift, so you get the next Taylor Swift on your Spotify. We're talking about a teenage boy who might be feeling lonely and is Googling how to not feel sad. And also they have the data point that they like this video game. And also they have this other data point about his favorite sports team. And what those marketers are going to do is essentially exploit that sadness through creating something, through that insight that they know they're feeling less than, they're feeling lonely. So let's trigger them with something. Maybe it is their favorite sports team. And it sends them down this rabbit hole of being a good consumer. And that becomes, I think, horrifyingly dangerous, especially when these kids don't know how this stuff works. We barely know how it works. So how are they supposed to understand when they Google how not to be sad? Or I say Google because I'm like a dinosaur compared to these kids. They're on TikTok saying, searching how not to be sad. And the algorithm serves up to them after so many videos, a cartoon on how to tie a noose around your neck to a song. Like, these are real things. And so it can feel like, what's the point? How do we fight this? But I think that's where the hope comes right now, because we have this sort of legislation coming in potentially up top, changing for safety for kids and adults. And then from the bottom, really educating and making, you know, parents and kids aware of what's happening so that we might get a culture shift.
Yeah. I think your verbiage helps because
I know I'm like a dark cloud.
Well, no, I like the verbiage. Is what I'm trying to say is I really liked the verbiage because it's a different thing to talk to your teen about, oh, you're on your phone too much, than to say, who's influencing you? Like, what's going on there? And how could we have less influence here of consumerism? Because we all know, I actually just talked to this man named David Thomas, who's he's a counselor, and he's saying, like, all of these things that we're turning to are numbing devices. They aren't really helping us feel better. It's not giving you what you actually need.
Right. It's triggering the dopamine without the following of the happiness hormone, of the actually feeling it, right? So it's just empty. And wait, you had just said something I wanted to say. Oh, when you say you should not be on your phone so much, we are handing something highly addictive to these kids and then shaming them for not being able to control themselves. They're not supposed to be able to control themselves. It's designed that way. When I started speaking about this in 2014, and when I was flying to the influencer conference where, you know, I ended up having a pseudo heart attack in the airport from overwork, I couldn't say these things as clearly because no one wanted to know or hear or weren't open to that they were scrambling their brains or their kids' brains.
Yes.
But now I eat crow for everything I did with Folk Rebellion. I tried to put the responsibility at the user's feet, at the human's feet. Oh, set boundaries. Oh, put it outside of your room. Oh, do this, do that. Guess what? It doesn't matter. Until this stuff is designed with our health as the core foundation, we can never have a healthy relationship with it because it's not designed to.
Sure. Wow. And you have a powerful story in there about flipping to the flip phone for a bit, but I don't want to go there quite yet. It's no secret. We love music in our household, and music lessons don't need to be expensive, boring, or stressful. Vogtberg Music Academy offers online lessons that siblings can share in the comfort of your own home. Instead of dragging kids to lessons and paying hundreds of dollars a month for one student, use my code OUTSIDE to get 50% off the first month when your children learns piano, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, or ukulele at vogtbergmusicacademy.com. For only $15, get weekly lessons and practice principles, 24/7 access to your instructor, live student onboarding calls, and video vaults that provide dozens of extra lessons for students who want to progress faster. With Vogtberg Music Academy, you will never have to nag your children to practice as they work toward earning badges on their success path and performing for community student showcases. Once again, use my code OUTSIDE to give it a try. You get 50% off this month and give your children a lifelong love of music at vogtbergmusicacademy.com. That's spelled Vogtberg musicacademy.com and use code OUTSIDE when you sign up. We love bread in our house. I mean, who doesn't? PB&Js, turkey sandwiches, even just morning toast with butter. It's all good in our home. We're always on the hunt for a healthy alternative. That's why our family loves Hero Bread. It is delicious. They make delicious bread and products free of consequences or compromise. They've made carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious versions that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories, plus protein and fiber. We love the classic white bread and the seeded bread, which are both made with olive oil and have a wonderful, rich taste to them. I was so surprised at how soft both types of bread were. They were just the right blend of chewiness and sturdiness for making sandwiches. This bread is a favorite in our house for sure. The tortillas were also delicious, and we loved making simple cheese quesadillas as a snack. We're talking zero net carbs, high in fiber, 0 grams of sugar. What more could you ask for? Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code OUTSIDE at checkout. That's code OUTSIDE at HERO.CO. I want to talk about this other thing that I had never heard this phrase before. So, like I said, you're in this really unique spot to bring this message because you're in this like middle ground and out front and experiencing all of this on the front lines. And someone talked to you about impression management. And I've never heard that phrase in my life. I guess we all have some sort of consideration to how we're perceived in the world, but we have really become this as a whole. Like every kid has a brand. You know, I was reading a book where, well, Jonathan Haidt's book, he's saying, you know, like this is taking up so much time. Everyone has a personal brand now. We're having to spend time that we would have spent doing embodied things, managing our personal brand. How do we look online? But one of the things I thought was so interesting was you said it's all premeditated. And I had this super interesting conversation this morning with someone that we were supposed to do a podcast interview. And she may listen to this. It's not a big deal. Like I wasn't like, whatever. But we're supposed to do this podcast interview today. And, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, with your folk rebellion or like, I don't know, I'm just one person. We don't have a staff. I don't answer a ton of emails. Like so much of our stuff falls through the cracks. So I'm like, well, you know, that's all I can do. So I can't. Yeah. I'm like, we're doing other things. We're outside for 1,000 hours. I don't have time to answer your email. She was asking for the questions ahead of time. She had sent an email. I didn't see it. I don't send my questions ahead of time. For the top reason is because I don't have them done ahead of time. You know, I prep the night before, and part of the reason I prep it the night before is so that it's fresh, right? If it's like 2 weeks later and sometimes it's happened, people have been sick and they don't come on for a couple of weeks or whatever. I'm like, oh, I don't quite remember what that story was or what did that really mean to me? So I tend to prep, you know, the week of, the night before. I don't have your questions ahead of time. But the thing about it is that that's not how life works. Like life doesn't work where we have the questions ahead of time.
Sure.
You have to be on the fly. And so I just thought this thought of that, like we've turned into this world where we like edit things before we send them and say them and post them is actually a really big deal.
It's huge.
Because then when we're in person and we're in these situations where you can't do that, like, do you think that we are hampered sort of because of all of that?
Yes. And so what's happening is the more you premeditate, think, then text, right? Think, then email, receive, you know, questions ahead of time. You are not showing up as like your innate self, right? You're showing up as your filtered version or your premeditated version. And what happens is when you end up in those places where you cannot do that, you feel really vulnerable and really scared. And this is one of the reasons why, like, I mean, there's a study that the less you make eye contact, right? It's tied to the phones. I haven't looked it up in 100 years, but I used to talk about this with Folk Rebellion. The less you make eye contact because you're making more eye contact with your screens, the less comfortable you are with it. And the less comfortable you are with it, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, the less eye contact you will make. And so the same can be said for gathering in real life for children, right? If they have not had to, and let's say they all get phones for middle school and everything is that sitting side by side, speaking through screens or looking at the screen and talking about what they see on the screen, right? As opposed to sitting face to face playing, that act becomes really difficult, really vulnerable, and they would rather just resort to this safe place on the internet. And there is this one thing someday, Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V, he's very famous, sort of, I would call him like an internet guru for people that wanted to really crush it during hustle culture, but he's since shifted, but he still has like this huge podcast and content series. But he had this one thing that he said, which was that he doesn't believe that the internet and Reddit and these safe spaces for young adults, specifically young men, young boys, is bad, and that he wishes He had had it when he was growing up because then he wouldn't have had to hide in the bathroom when he was, getting picked on or something like that, which of course nobody wants their kids to be picked on. No one wants
Right.
to be picked on. But what Gary missed, and someday I want to talk to him about this, is Gary, you are only you because you had to overcome and deal with that. Had you had a safe space to hide on the internet with other people who you've never really met in real life, you would have never had to have figured out how to come out of that bathroom, how to overcome, whatever it was you were dealing with. And so there's this idea that the more premeditated we are, the more safe spaces, safe, they're not safe at all, but they're more comfortable to children and teenagers and young adults and now, millennials who've spent a lot of their time in these places, that the real world becomes horrifying or
Yeah.
nerve-wracking, scary. You see this with the dating apps.
Yeah. And what you see now, this is what I am seeing. And I just was talking about this with this David, is that there's less of a pool of people to connect with.
That's the hard
And
part.
that's tricky to begin with because we only connect with, your soul kind of connects, right? It's like you connect with who you connect with. And as a parent, sometimes you're like, well, I hope my kid connects with this kid because I get along with the mom or whatever the situation is. But you can't force that. I mean, we connect with who we connect with. And when there's less people in general to connect with, your chances of finding that friend or finding whatever, that boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever it is, that becomes harder too. And we are seeing that like on the front lines with our own kids, that there's just less options of people in general. So I love how you frame things, Jessica. So we're talking about influence detox versus digital detox. That helps me to look at things differently. We're talking about impression management versus being just an authentic person. And how can I, truth be told, I'm like that too. I mean, I'm like, I don't want to put my face on this camera, which is kind of dumb because I know we're talking about like not doing that last, but I'm like, well, how does my hair look today? I mean, this is, oh, and so I just don't do it.
Right? We all care about these things. I mean, we could even just say, like, what's influencing us to care about those things, right? So that's what my brain does every single time. Like, why do I care? So
Well, and I care because the prettiest people get seen the most. I mean, that is the truth. And I actually was just thinking about that the other day. Like, why is that? It's just because we like to look at beauty. Is it because the algorithm is serving that up? But it is true. And I had a friend just the
doing
other day who
it.
was like,
It's doing it.
she was like, I couldn't be that person because I don't look like that person. I couldn't sell those products. I mean, this was the conversation that we were having. And I was like, well, I think you're beautiful. She was like, yeah, but I know. She goes, I know I'm not. And that's how I feel. I'm like, I know I'm not. I know I don't look that way. So I'm not even going to strive for that type of thing. There's a lot going on here. And I'm like in my 40s.
No, it's because, right, ex imagine being 12. And so
Right.
there's so many layers of this cultural influence to that everything you just said right there. Who dictates the beauty standards? Why do they make them a certain way? Why does the algorithm favorite these certain things? Who's benefiting off of the algorithm only prioritizing these types of things, right? So I would say it probably goes back to the makeup brands and the beauty brands and things, so, or media, magazine
Clothing.
culture. So clothing, exactly. So imagine being 12. Just imagine. I couldn't. I just can't. And I used to think that young people don't want older people to talk about their generation because, of course, every generation you have the old people trying to tell them what to do. This is significantly different than anything in our world ever. And we are the adults in the room. We are. And we did this in some way, shape, or form. We did this. And so we have to try and like fix it for these kids because if I had to grow up comparing myself and seeing these things and seeing how the algorithm shifts, how everybody looks the same, I would be wholly unwell. And Jonathan Haidt talks about this, of the mental illness and the mental health problems of specifically girls, because you have that comparison and beauty culture problem, again, leading to depression and suicide. And yeah, it's, I mean, I'm sorry to say, I love how your brain is thinking right now. And on the flip side, I acknowledge it in my book of like, I understand that the successes that I had in my life were because not only of how I carried myself, because I did work and learn very hard how to persuade and get people to like me. And, you know, that's the start of the book of understanding my background to know why I learned how people operate. But I also know it's because of how I look. Right. I understand that a lot of what I have achieved, maybe just by getting my foot in the door. And I think there's a line in there that says, like, I am the daughter of two well-spoken, slightly manipulative, beautiful people. And this is not a brag, it's just a fact. Right. And so I can understand how that has influenced where I sit today and acknowledge it.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about. And I love when you bring in your childhood because you say, I mean, this is a huge thing. You said, I had a whole offline life before my 20s, hobbies, friends, time in nature, real analog experiences. And yet I still fell prey to the powerful influences of the tech world. So the question is what happens then to a generation of kids who don't have that foundation of hobbies? I mean, they don't have it. They don't have hobbies, friends, time in nature, real analog experiences. These are the types of things that don't exist in mass anymore. How do they cope?
Well, I think that's what we're experiencing right now. They are they're lonely, they're isolated, they're very anxious. Their health is suffering because, you know, as the cell phone and iPad usage has gone up, something as simple as bike riding. I think the stat used to be had declined by 30%. I'm sure now it's by like 60, right?
Right.
We're in an epidemic. We're in an epidemic. And I don't think that all is lost. Like, that's the thing. There's easy changes that can be made. And one of the things I want to leave you with on this also that's really important is how you were saying earlier that they don't have other people to commune with because everybody else is also doing the same thing on their phones, or they don't have analog things because we've just not bought them, right? There's no record player to go to someone's basement anymore and like put the record player on and throw a
Sure.
party, right? They don't exist. So it's about building a network of it's easier to opt out, it's easier to make change when it's like, okay, this group of five families has decided, we're gonna make a Goonies group, which means like all houses are open. We'll feed any kids. We expect them to be outside, not know where they are, and ring each other's doorbells, right? But the one rule is they have to be home by 9, right? Or we're going to, push back on the school who has said, oh, we need ed tech before sixth grade. And so it's about getting as many people together to adopt the same sort of thing. What tech companies are trying to do is cannibalize everything in its path. So the things that made me
Yes.
happy, writing, drawing, listening to music, photography have been stolen by the phone. So start to
Wow.
return things in the real world. Get a camera. Yes, it's going to be entirely different than shooting on your iPhone. But I bet you, if you're using a film camera or even a digital camera, the way you take photos changes. Maybe it's more about photography and less about documentation. I tried to create, I know, like, I study all I can about actually biologically what this stuff is doing to us. So I know that viewing or experiencing memories through a screen makes us like half as happy than if it's in the real world. So, for example, viewing a photo on your phone, showing a photo to your kid on your phone, biologically, like the happiness is 50% less or 40% less than if they had held a photo album because we are just analog creatures. We are not
Right.
digital creatures. And so, okay, if the world is anxious and all kids are sad, how can I make them feel more happy? Well, give them real things in real life, right?
Yeah.
So, real friendships in real life, spend time, with real mediums if you can. And it's hard. It's going to be hard. It's easy to give your kids these things. And it's especially easy when it's being forced down our throats in everything from schools to doctors' offices. But while it is an epidemic, I think the work of people like Jonathan Haidt and mama, and so many other people out there who are sounding the alarm. Like, we're in a moment. We're in a moment. And so I would just encourage anyone who doesn't like what they're seeing. I say in the book, like, go out there and make trouble. And make trouble could be literally emailing a teacher and saying, hey, I heard there's a study that kids are 40% dumber if they learn through screens. When are you returning to pen and paper? Just assume it and make them tell you, make them qualify why they're doing this stuff.
Or just say, my kid only does the pen and paper assignments. I think that's fine to say,
yeah,
when we homeschool. But I'm like, if I didn't homeschool, I would just say, like, I'm not doing the homework. It's really a tricky situation because it can make your child the black sheep. But I like the idea of bringing in a couple more. Like, if you can find a couple more families that say, you know what, we have set aside the afternoon for play. And so we're not going to be doing these homework assignments for our 7-year-olds or our 8-year-olds. I don't know. Then there's power in numbers a little bit. I love the idea of building a network.
This podcast is sponsored by Active Skin Repair, a 1% for the planet member who believes personal health and health of the environment are connected. If you spend as much time outside as we do, which we hope you do, or really any time outside at all for that matter, you're bound to have kids that get nicked, scraped, or banged up, or perhaps come in from outside with an unexplained rash, or maybe you end up on the wrong side of a fall or a bad scrape yourself. That's why we love Active Skin Repair. Active Skin Repair is an all-natural and non-toxic topical solution that is formulated to help repair and heal damaged skin. It can be used to treat a wide range of skin issues, including cuts, scrapes, but also burns, sunburns, rashes, and other types of skin damage. It works by mimicking the natural immune response to help soothe irritation, reduce inflammation, and support healing. It's also safe and non-toxic, making it suitable for use on all skin types, including sensitive skin. It's really easy to add to your first aid kit. As if all of that wasn't amazing enough, Active Skin Repair donates 1% of all sales to grassroots environmental initiatives to protect and restore our national world, which is super cool. Visit activeskinrepair.com to learn more about Active Skin Repair and their commitment to 1% for the planet. You can use code 1000hours to save 20% on all Active Skin Repair products. That's activeskinrepair.com.
I'm thirsty. Just think how many times you hear that when you're at the sports field with your kids or out on a hot summer hike or just driving around in the car. Water is obviously a go-to, but have you ever thought about healthy hydration? Element is a zero-sugar electrolyte drink mix born from the growing body of research revealing that optimal health outcomes occur at sodium levels 2 to 3 times government recommendations. Electrolyte deficiency or imbalance can cause headaches, cramps, fatigue, brain fog, and weakness. Element helps anyone stay hydrated as each stick pack delivers a meaningful dose of electrolytes free of sugar, artificial colors, or other dodgy ingredients found in popular electrolyte and sports drinks. That's why Element is trusted and used by everyone from the Olympic weightlifting team, NFL and NBA players, Stanford neuroscientists, and everyday moms like me. Our kids actually fight over them. We keep the stick packs with us when we are on the go. They're super convenient. Head directly to our exclusive page at drinklmnt.com/1000hours to receive a free Element sample pack with any order. That's drinklmnt.com/1000hours to get your free sample pack with your order.
We're just trying to get kids outside. Like, I've got a 15-year-old. He's expected to be outside this year for 1,000 hours with our family. It's almost always with friends because nobody wants to go outside by themselves. And so just these, it's, the problem is that the answers are simple, but they're not easy.
Exactly.
They're simple to understand. We actually don't have as many of these problems just because we don't have the time for it. It's like, well, the kids were outside, so there was less time for screens. And they're learning that they like that. And it's easier to say no because they can go find something else to do. But it's not easy because it's easier to pacify, or it's easier. And there's always things. My friends are on, or whatever all the other stuff is. But it's very important for them to grow up with having the influences that we had. You know, that Jean Twenge talks about generational change. So she's like, some of them are innocuous, but some of them are not innocuous. And this is one of those ones that is not innocuous. They have to have had analog experiences in childhood so that they have something to come back to when they become parents or they become adults and they are facing stress.
The hope is that they build up so much connection or hobbies away from these things, that when they are introduced, because they will be, right?
Yes.
When they are introduced at an age when it's appropriate for a specific activity, whether it's schoolwork or whatever, it doesn't hold the allure because they have had a whole childhood of in real life friendships, of, you know, sports, of climbing trees, of a hobby that maybe happens offline. And so, you know, my son, it's this book, like you said, Strength in Numbers, this book is my attempt at the greatest strengths in numbers I could ever have, because he looked at me one day and his friend had, you know, he'd gone over to his friend's house and they were making a video, which my son had never done before. And the kid had like a YouTube channel. And I'm not a monster. When you're at other kids' houses, you get to participate in their world. But, you know, he knew, he said, "You don't have my consent to put that on the internet." And he came home and he's like, "Mom, I know these things because you know these things, but the other families, they don't know these things. And then I'm the weird kid. Can't you just tell everybody these things?" And so I wrote this book for him.
Yes. Yes, I can. Here it is. Here, yeah, that's beautiful. And all you need is just a few other families. You build your network. And I'll tell you what, our oldest son, 15, he asked for a record player for Christmas. So, and he's got, he loves amazing to go to the record shop.
I'm just sorry to interrupt, like how that grows, right? So he grows older. When he travels, he would visit potentially the local record store, and each album is a memory of a place he's been. So these things grow and they build and they snowball into more emotional and connected things. And so, bravo. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it was neat. I'm like, I didn't even have one of those. It was so good. I just talked briefly about the fact that you had the dumb phone for a little while. I thought your insights there when you had it were really powerful. One of the things that you talked about was this information withdrawal that you had, because now it's like, oh, I can check. What about this? What about that? What about this? I'm going to check. There's a parade this weekend. What time is it at? What this, that? And all of a sudden your answers are not right there at your fingertips. How did you handle that?
Oh, it felt awful. It felt, that was like a true detox. It felt, my brain, like they joke, or they don't joke, they say it's like monkey brain, like in meditation, yes, if you can't quiet. It felt like there was a monkey in my brain jumping from one thing to another, trying to get out, trying to attach itself to something. I felt like that for a significantly long period of time. It was quite a few days before that started to calm down. But what I did, and I talk about this, whenever you remove anything, any big influence in your life, like a cell phone or something, you can't create a vacuum where it was. You can't just leave empty space there because you're going to drive yourself nuts and then want to return to it. So you have to try and fill it with something else. And so for me, I filled it with photography. I mean, I did, you know, film photography, black and white. Is what I went and studied in Europe when I was very young. And so I returned to that. And so that helped. But the other thing that I noticed was that in having all the answers at my fingertips, I didn't have to ask anyone for anything. So, you know, I bartended a long time ago. I write about that in the book too. And I can remember some of the best banter and conversations I've ever had were in a bar with people who were all strangers, but bored and sitting there together looking for connection. And something as simple as, oh yeah, what year was, you know, Woodstock? You couldn't search it up. So you had to turn potentially to the person to the left or right of you, and then a discussion would ensue. No, I think it's this time. Well, my dad was born here. Oh yeah. Well, my dad went. Oh, where are you from? And what happens is we're sensing all of this potential connection. Right. So you're walking down the street and you need directions. You are potentially not going to get that meet cute because you don't have to ask that cute guy or girl for directions to the place you're going because you have your phone. So we are stunting all of this sort of natural way of humans operating in the world that creates potential for things in the future. I have this one experience that I'm really ashamed of, but it was the first time I went out without my phone. This was before I started Folk Rebellion. I went to an unplugged adult summer camp for a week because I was interested in this. And it was in Northern California, and they took your phones, and it was a whole thing. still friends with some of the people to this day. But what they did is they gave you like a little notebook for your back pocket. So when you reached for your phone, which was likely in your back pocket, you would pull out your notebook instead. And there was prompts in there. One of them was to chicken scratch every time you reached for your phone and write a note about what you were doing or why you reached for it. And the thing I discovered that about myself, which I am, again, ashamed of, was that anytime I was in small talk, introduced to somebody I didn't know, I would do my niceties, my front of house management, impression management, mm-hmm. and I would attempt to exit the conversation because I am an introvert at heart and I really did not like small talk. I still don't to this day. And I'd go and I'd reach for my phone and my phone wasn't there. So spoiler, I ended up becoming very good friends with one of these people that I was, my instinct was to reach for my phone and end the conversation. And so I think about how many missed opportunities or things that I've stunted, opportunities for connection, right? With these kids are lonely, sad, depressed, anxious, we don't know why. Like they are missing the opportunity to talk to somebody for directions, to have a chat with a bus driver, to potentially make a new friend, because again, they're uncomfortable. You know, some people are innately uncomfortable, but as more of us feel that way, we are not allowing ourselves our full human experience.
Wow, Jessica, that is powerful because it's twofold. We're missing the conversations because the information is there, and we're missing the conversations because we can just grab that phone if we feel uncomfortable and it pulls us out. I just love that you wrote, all I had to do was accept it's okay not to know. There's like a little bit of a humbling humanity piece there. Like, oh yeah, of course. It's like, oh yeah, I want all the information. I want to be able to, but then you're like, well, there's a lot of pressure there. You know, is what, can we go back to the time in life when we're just like, I don't know that. I don't know any of that stuff.
Exactly. You're pulling these in, not even just information, these other people's environments into your world. And, you know, everybody's tired. Everybody's overwhelmed. And I would say that it's for, the amount of information, I mean, we're being like blasted with a fire hose. And again, it's our body becomes accustomed to the knowing or the searching because it's tied to, you know, if I had to open an encyclopedia every time, I probably wouldn't be doing it as often. But because it's a device that is so easy, right? And then it has that, again, dopamine responses in there and triggers. Yeah, it's just...
It makes me think about the encyclopedia because it wasn't one. There was not one encyclopedia. It was like a whole shelf, right? And then you had to find it. It was like alphabetized. And then sometimes what you wanted to know wasn't in there, or it would be like, see this. And so then you had to get out a different encyclopedia. And so you just are okay with not knowing, or you ask someone else and it's a relationship builder. I thought this part about the dumb phone, I mean, there's so much in this book, but this part, you talked about the audio connection, that you had more conversations, and that audio has the ability, like a real voice, the ability to alter your biological response. My favorite paragraph in the whole book, Jessica, was this. Oftentimes people think the ditching of my phone is a desire for less, when really it is just a desire for more of the important things. I am a person who shows up, who really shows up in real life. This means I'm not a glow face when talking to my son. I'm not a multitasking mom at the playground. I used to be both of those things. But then you did say, I lost friends. I lost business. I lost respect. I was mocked. I was judged. I was ridiculed. But I never lost myself when I was living with intention. So there's so many beautiful threads. We've just kind of scratched the surface of what I have here in my notes. But the book is Raising Hell, Living Well, Freedom from Influence. That's the thing. That is the thing. It's not really freedom from screens, because mm-hmm. there's some screen things that are really fun and you sit and play video games together with your kid, or you watch a movie together. It's not really the freedom from screens. It's the freedom from influence that we're trying to pull away from in a world where everyone wants something from you. You have a Substack that people can go and find more about. I'm going to say Modern BS, but it's actually longer than that because you've got the clean rating. And I'll put it in the show notes. People can find you on Instagram at Folk Rebellion, JessicaElefante.com. Jessica, we always end our show with the same question. And you were like the Elefante. It's like the four, you had the siblings. So the question is, what's a favorite memory from your childhood that was outside?
Oh, I could tell you right away. The first one that comes to mind, next door to our house was an empty lot where they would dump, piles and piles of dirt. They were going to build something someday. They never built anything. It became weeded over. It was like a jungle of these mountainous hills. And we played in there every single day. My mother was a get outside, don't come home till supper, screen door bang on the way out. And we were heathens. I was the oldest of four, one boy, two younger sisters, and we would play King of the Mountain. And the whole idea was to get on top of your mountain and be the king, which meant you could do anything you could to get the other ones to not be the king. So this resulted in a lot of pushing and rolling down hills and maybe some fighting. And at one point, my brother got so angry that he could not, take my mountain. He threw a boulder at my head, and I have stitches right here that you can still see. My hair grows a funny way now because I got knocked off that mountain and laid there, passed out, and my brother hid in the car, and then my sisters had to go get my parents. And it's like family, lore.
Yeah, it's your family folklore. I love that because that's all the way through your book. Oh my goodness. And you almost got in Cal Newport's book?
Yes, he interviewed me for digital minimalism, and it ended up getting cut at the end, which is totally fine because now he's just like someone who's been really supportive and he's brilliant. His is more, he's very actionable, right? How to, change things and fix things in your world. And I guess for me, I'm a little bit more like philosophical, look inside, look at the world around you and, see how it affects you.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was cool. I love digital minimalism. Jessica, this has been awesome. I think that the way that you frame things has helped me to see things differently. And also it will facilitate discussions with my kids that go a different direction, that are more meaningful and less surface because of the way that you have laid things out in this book. So really thank you for being here, for taking the time to have this conversation with us. And maybe someday we'll be at Aaron's Yurts together.
Oh, we will be. I'm going to make it happen at some point. Thank you so much for today. This was a really, really lovely interview. And I'm so glad you didn't send questions beforehand because I just want to be me and I want you to just be you. And it felt really good. So this was fun.
Thank you.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play, and we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.